This is Classic Rain Hamcast number 26, posted August 22nd, 2020. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. This week we conclude our second excerpt from an interview conducted earlier this year with Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, the most communicative and personable bureaucrat Rain founder Hap Holly, KC9RP, had the pleasure of speaking with during Hap's 30 years, 1990 to 2020, that he served as director of the Rain Report. During the 1990s, Riley was special counsel for amateur radio enforcement for the Federal Communications Commission. This week, we'll conclude a 2020 conversation with Riley by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, recorded for Eric's QSO Today podcast.
I remember that, like every major city in Orange County, the FCC had a huge property in the middle of the county where they had their antennas and their monitoring stations. And I think that probably every major city had an FCC monitoring station. Was this reduction in government the reason that these went away?
Yeah, just we're coming off of 20 years now of reducing government, you know, big government to little government, and something's got to give. They have half the number of field offices that they had even 10 or 12 years ago. But the thing is, the huge real estate that you saw was the antenna system. Now, the FCC still has its 12 or 13 antenna fields around the country. It's just that with the evolution of computers and the Intel chip and so forth, they didn't need to have somebody sitting right there doing the monitoring anymore. All of the fields are tied into the high-frequency direction finding center in Columbia, Maryland. And so you don't need all those field offices just for the antennas. But you do need bigger field offices in the bigger cities, which they are suffering in that regard because they have half the number of engineers, less than half the number of field offices. But the monitoring still continues.
So the issues of spectrum enforcement or the issues of abuse on radio frequencies has not gone away. In fact, maybe it's increased?
It hasn't gone away. You would think it'd be a lot worse than it is. But in regard to amateur frequency, some of it is the sign of the times. It's just the way society is today. People are more rude, and they're selfish. They're thin-skinned, and sometimes when you're trying to do somebody a favor, they get suspicious. You see that attitude in shopping centers or at the beach or whatever. People are just different these days. For example, 25 years ago, if somebody got an official observer notice from the league about something wrong with their signal, they would be grateful because they would think, well, I'm sure glad I heard from the league rather than the FCC. But in today's society, even when you're trying to do somebody a favor, they will all take offense. We didn't have road rage in those days and all the crazy things that we have. It's just people are different these days. And so I think that's the main reason for some of the conduct problems on the amateur bands, mostly 75 meters. But overall, considering the number of licensees we have, overall everything works really good.
You were saying earlier that you became involved in amateur radio enforcement. How did that happen, and what happened there?
Well, I had worked in the land mobile area and then later moved to the Gettysburg office to work more specifically in land mobile licensing and just general licensing. We had meetings at headquarters about once a week, so I was down for a meeting. And Rich Lee, the enforcement bureau chief, showed me a letter that the league had written. And I wasn't all that active at that particular time. Maybe I made 20 contacts a year or something, but I was focused on other things. But the letter implored the commission to get back into amateur radio because nothing had been done for 12 years. And Rich said, what's this about? And I said, well, it's been a 12-year hiatus in this service. Because of the explosion of land mobile and trunking and cellular and everything else, they just haven't had the staff. And he said, well, how many amateur licensees are there? And I think at that point, there's about 650 to 700,000, somewhere along in there. And I told him, he said, well, we can't have a large group of licensees thinking they're getting no service from the FCC, no enforcement. I'm going to look into this. He did. And about a month later, he called and said, I'm still looking into this and I can't get anything going. Would you be willing to see what you can do with this program and to get enforcement started? And I said, I would. I'd be very interested in doing it, but I did not want to leave the Gettysburg office. I said, I don't know if it can be done, Rich, because 12 years is a long time to have no enforcement. He said, well, I'll make a deal with you. He said, you get it straightened out. I won't be breathing down your neck. I won't micromanage you. If you can't do it, you'll be cooking squirrel under a bridge somewhere. later on. And I said, well, that's a great deal, Rich. I'll take you up on that. I did it. He basically left me alone. And the reason it went so well was because nothing had been done. I mean, if you lived beside an old house for 12 years and nobody had maintained it or painted it, anybody could come rambling up there and paint it and improve it, and it would look wonderful. I started from zero. We had 90.9% cooperation from the amateur service. And so it was just the right time and the right place, and they were welcoming enforcement because nothing had been done for so long.
Well, what did enforcement look like to amateur radio operators when you came on and reinitiated the program there at the FCC?
Well, it was a lot of deliberate interference and arguing. You had different factions on 75 meters, and you had a faction on 20 meters. A lot of things that if somebody that wasn't an amateur operator, well, even an amateur operator, you'd listen to it, you'd be embarrassed, and you'd think, this is the amateur service. This sounds more like the end days of the CB service. It was the broken window theory. If you let the windows get broken out of an old building, it just gets worse and worse. But if you do minimum maintenance on it, show up and ask what's going on and talk to this group one-on-one and say, look, you guys can do this, but do you really want to do it? If you're having that much trouble with the frequency, look at your radio and you'll see one big knob, and that's to change frequencies. Every radio that's ever been made in the amateur service has one big knob. Just don't get into this, because if you do, we're coming after you because we can find other violations in there. And I think just having some attention paid to it would made a world of difference.
I think you have a presentation up on YouTube or something called One Big Knob. Is that right?
I think so, yeah.
Do you have any enforcement stories in the amateur division that might interest the listeners? Something that was incredibly outside of what we would think that would happen in the amateur bands?
I have a lot of enforcement stories. I won't bore you with them, but I think the one that I remember the most is, now when I started listening heavily on the amateur bands again, as I said, when I got started in this again, I wasn't that active, but I was appalled at what things sounded like and how people acted and deliberately jammed each other and so forth. But one Friday afternoon, I was sitting there particularly aggravated over a case in Georgia. And I'm thinking, now this is probably going to ruin my weekend. Maybe I should just try to call the guy and talk to him one-on-one, because that works well a lot of times if you can talk to somebody one-on-one. So I decided to do it, because I know if I didn't do it, it would probably ruin my whole weekend. So about 5:30, I called down and his wife answered the phone, and I said, well, what's that? I'd like to speak to the amateur radio operator there, Mr. So-and-so. And she said, well, he gets home at 6. What's this about? And so I guess my better judgment, I told her that we'd gotten a ton of complaints. We had tapes submitted and so forth of the conduct that was coming from the station and so forth, and the deliberate interference and so forth. And there was a little bit of a pause, and I said, just have him call me when he comes in, if you wouldn't. I gave him my number, and there was a little bit of a pause, and she said, well, he won't have to call you. And I said, well, I really would like for him to call me. I just need to talk to him for a few minutes. And she said, you won't need to talk to him because, as I said, he gets home about 6, and I can guarantee you that after 6:15 tonight, you will never have this problem again. And we didn't, and I never heard anything from him or about him after that. So I don't know what she did, but it solved the problem. And then I found out that the best enforcement tool in the world sometimes is a wife or girlfriend standing in the door of the radio room unnoticed.
And you didn't have to check a police blotter for his local neighborhood to see if anything happened that night?
I often wondered whatever happened to him, but at that time we'd take enforcement any way we could get it, so we just left it alone. But as far as I know, he was never on the radio again. He could be buried in the backyard, for all I know.
Under your tutelage, how did that end up evolving? And does the FCC still enforce this way today?
Well, like I say, 99% of the amateur operators wanted enforcement. They were very appreciative of it because they had been neglected for so many years. It evolved in just more self-policing, which is what we're supposed to be doing anyway. And people just got more conscious of it, more aware of it.
You're listening to an excerpt from a 2020 conversation with former FCC bureaucrat Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, recorded by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, for QSO Today, Eric's weekly amateur radio podcast. We'll conclude our excerpt from this interview after station identification. This is the Classic Rain Hamcast. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Classic Rain from www.therainreport.com.
Beep.
It's like the seatbelt when they came out. They wouldn't pull you over for not wearing a seatbelt. It had to be some other violation. But I noticed, and I did the same thing, that when people would see a police car, they would naturally reach over and feel and make sure they had the seatbelt on. It's just the awareness that enforcement is out there. Just the general awareness changes a lot of attitude. If they had the feeling that the bans were neglected by the FCC, then why should they care about them? So just raising the awareness of what the service is supposed to be doing and what it's supposed to be accomplishing, and knowing that somebody cared about it from the entity that licensed it in the first place, I think makes the difference.
Does the FCC still have an enforcement bureau?
Oh, yes, definitely. They're stretched pretty thin. They have a lot more issues. It's not just about RF anymore. If any of the listeners want to see just briefly what the FCC does on any given week, just go to FCC.gov, search the Daily Digest, and you'll see a whole page of all the actions that the FCC did the day before or in the days before. And you'd be amazed at the things on there that aren't just about RF anymore. They have a huge responsibility just in non-RF areas.
Like telecommunications, the internet, things like that, right?
Yeah, robocalls, universal service fund fraud, and things like that. It's not just about monitoring.
I'm lucky I don't get robocalls, but when I visit my father in America, these calls come in every night. There could be 6 or 7 calls every night. What can people in America do about robocalls? Is there anything they can do?
In fact, the Supreme Court just ruled that you can ban robocalls, and they did not allow the exception for calls from the government or bill collecting. So robocalls are banned, and there are some very huge forfeitures or fines that are given to these robocallers. I personally like the robo detector program on my cell phone. It was a little program where when a robocall came in, I don't know exactly how it detected robocalls, but it would be some celebrity like Cher saying, "Oh, you've gotten me right during my, I'm on a break in my concert. Just give me a few minutes and I'll get right back to you." Or it'll be a little kid on there asking a lot of questions. Just something that took up so much time from the robocaller that they end up disconnecting. But robocalls are not legal, and the Supreme Court just upheld that this week, actually.
Is there like some international enforcement? Because those robocalls could actually be coming from offshore.
I don't know how they do it. They work with the telephone company and the cellular carriers.
Yeah, unfortunately, my father just doesn't answer the phone anymore. So it's kind of like made the phone practically useless.
Yeah, it's very annoying. Now, we don't have them to that degree here nowadays. They've been getting less and less. In fact, the program I have on my phone hasn't detected anything in the last 6 or 8 months. So they're being reduced a lot. But the forfeitures, the fines are huge, just like in the old days of mass fax going out to people.
Out of curiosity, do people operating cellular phones in America, do they pay for airtime in both directions? So if you receive an incoming call, are you actually paying for the airtime?
No, not anymore. In fact, long-distance calls are free, and all you're really paying for is cellular data, I think, and, of course, the unit itself. But there's unlimited long-distance. Unlimited long-distance and the cellular data plans are very generous. So I have the same phone bill every month. In fact, last summer, I made about 300 calls in the period of 2 to 3 months setting up this volunteer monitor program. Yeah, my bill stayed the same.
You just mentioned the Volunteer Monitor Program. That was my next question. What is the Volunteer Monitor Program?
Well, as the FCC was gradually cut back in the staff sense, the League for 50 years has had the Official Observer Program. So the FCC suggested in 2017 that maybe the League would want to beef up the Official Observer Program and rebrand it and have better training and better management. And in exchange for that, the FCC would work with the volunteer monitors and take cases that they referred and handle them on an expedited basis, because they knew that they no longer had the resources to send field engineers out to monitor for several days trying to get enforcement evidence. So the League Board approved it. And the Volunteer Monitor Program is the old Official Observer Program on speed, so to speak. The deal is that we have better training, better coordination, a fewer number. We have 195 volunteer monitors. That is much more manageable than having 500 or 600 official observers, although out of that 500 or 600, there were maybe 200, 250 that were active. The League helped in the training, and the League participates in webinars that we have for the volunteer monitors. And what we do is just voluntarily monitor the bans, and serious rule discrepancies, we send a notice out an advisory notice first, and if it continues two or three times, then it goes to the FCC, and they promise that when a case comes from the Volunteer Monitor Program, they'll give it expedited action so that it doesn't just get in queue in the online complaint process. Also, they wanted rebranding, as I said, so we totally changed the name of it. We have Volunteer Counsel, Volunteer Examiner, so we decided we should probably call it the Volunteer Monitor Program. But we also send out, and the FCC wanted this, good operator notices, which are recognitions that we do quarterly of 10 or 15 cases of outstanding operation. And the last quarter was the first time we had done that, the quarter ending at the end of March. And as it turns out, several of those getting the good operator notices were teenagers that had just gotten into amateur radio. So we were pretty happy about that.
Now, are you using some kind of technology now? I mean, I think I remember the official observers would actually send out handwritten postcards. Or ARRL volunteer monitor stations, are they actually using some kind of infrastructure now to make their reports? Some larger system generates those messages?
It's not automated yet. It would be were it not for the shutdown, you know, from the coronavirus. They're sent out by hand, but they are written notices. And where we can, we deal with the apparent discrepancy by one-on-one contact, as I said earlier. That seems to work in a lot of cases, or by email if we can find an email address. And in every case but one, we've gotten a quick response back saying, I appreciate your pointing this out to me. I thought I could do FT8 on a certain frequency as a technician. Now I understand I can't, or something like that. I think it's working very well because we have dozens and dozens of cases where we contacted the person and pointed out some element of the operation, such as out of band, and they immediately responded and the problem stopped. And that's the whole point of enforcement. So we have a couple of cases that we have referred to the FCC, and they're doing the direction finding to locate the interference and so forth. But overall, we've been able to handle it in-house, which is the whole point, because amateur radio is supposed to be self-policing.
Up until recently, you were the ARRL Atlantic Division Vice Director. How important are the regional directors and vice directors to amateur radio around the U.S., and what is their role?
Well, there are directors and vice directors. When you say regional director, that is a term used for the FCC office. There are three of them, three regional directors. The league's directors are just that, division directors. You have 13 divisions, such as the Atlantic Division and the Southwestern Division and so forth, and they all have vice directors. The directors and their section managers are the ones that do all the work, and they go to all the amateur meetings, the ham fest, the club meetings, and talk to the amateur operators and listen to their issues and what they want. And then they meet twice a year, although they're communicating all the time.
And that concludes our second and final excerpt from a conversation with Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, Special Counsel for Amateur Radio Enforcement for the Federal Communications Commission during the 1990s, recorded by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, for QSO Today in 2020. Audio credit to QSO Today. You can hear Eric's entire 53-minute conversation with Riley on qsotoday.com. Archive file 311. The Classic Rain Hamcast is copyright 1987-2020 Rain. All rights reserved. Classic Rain 27 will post September Labor Day weekend. Now for Rain's founder, Hap Holly, KC9RP, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73. Keep on hamming!